everybody. I am here with Todd from Todd's Nerd Cave / Retro Frog. What's up, man? How you doing?
Not too bad, and you?
Pretty good. Good to see you. Been a while since we talked. I don't think we've ever video chatted before, but you know, we've met in person, so yep. Cheers to you. Wish I was there with a beer and not here with a coffee.
Yeah.
So how you been?
Good. Just trying to stay busy.
That you are. So behind you, are those your 3D print shop that you've been printing out of? Is that your main stations?
Yeah, this is part of it. This is about half of it. I have my office here. I've got over in the corner over here, there's two Prusa Mini Pluses, and then directly behind me, the ones with the blue and the green spools, those are Prusa Mark III's, 3S Pluses. And then downstairs, I have two more Minis and a upgraded Ender 3.
That's awesome. I still haven't gotten one. I still got to just finish off a million other projects. But the one thing I'm worried about is, like, I see you have dedicated desk space there for them. Mm-hmm. Like, how bad would it be if I put them on, like, the bottom shelf of a bookcase so that, like, it's not on the top, so it's not wiggling around, because I know that would set it off center? Is that just a nightmare, or should I just make sure to find a flat surface on top of something?
You'd probably want to make sure whatever it is sturdy. I mean, if you can go to the bookshelf and just kind of lightly push on and it rocks back and forth, that's not the right surface for you. Plus, yeah, a lot of these printers, you probably want to put some isolation under them anyways, because the whole machine, when it's printing, generates a lot of movement, and all that transfers down into whatever it's setting on. So if it's setting on something kind of wobbly, it's going to get that going on. Even these printers that are relatively quiet, there's still lots of momentum in the bed going back and forth. So yeah, I would probably make sure whatever you put it on, if it's a stand or a rack or something, just to make sure that it's got some sort of sturdiness to it.
One of the projects that I'm going to be working on as soon as I have a breath is to tear apart my garage, because there's some, like, crappy old cabinets, and every time you open one up, you know, a giant mutant spider comes and, you know, detaches to my face like I'm seeing an alien. It's just, while I'm exaggerating, I'm actually not. Every time I open one of those up, there's spider eggs and things, and I got to just rip all that out and put new shelving up. So I was thinking maybe to get at least one or two hard surfaces, just that way I could leave the printer going for something, and if it's in the middle of the night, I'm not even going to hear it because it's in the garage.
Yeah, because you live out in the country now, don't you?
Yeah, not country. Like, I can't talk to somebody who lives in the, you know, the middle states and call where I live country, because that's not fair at all. But yeah, compared to the middle of Manhattan, yes, I'm in the country.
Yeah, because
like there's like three chipmunks running around in front of me. There's all different colors of birds and stuff. There's a fox that runs by every night. I found a fox hole in my backyard. I don't know if you've ever seen one of those, but I'm like, hey, why is the grass a little sunk down here? And I hit it with a shovel, and it just goes woof, and there's a hole in there. I'm like, wow, is that a sinkhole? And then I peeled the grass up, and I was like, holy shit, that must be a foxhole. This is crazy. Like, it's like an entire ecosystem underneath, like, a foot of dirt, which is under the grass. And I'm like, I'm going to fill that with rocks. I don't know if that's good or not. Filled it up with rocks, filled it with dirt on top, put the grass back on. I'm good.
Yeah, you're not used to that in a city, are you?
No. In the entire time I lived there, I think I saw three or four roaches in the apartment total, ever. Mm-hmm. I saw two or three mice, little ones, never a rat, and tons of roaches, giant roaches down in the laundry room, but never in the apartment. But that was it. That was the extent of the wildlife in New York City, was that. And pigeons, which are just rats with wings anyway, so.
Yeah, because I live out in the, well, I don't know if I'd say country either, but where I live is, you know, all old farm, developed farmland. And if you, like, go across the street from the subdivision, where I live at, big farm full of corn. So yeah, I live out in the, I don't know if I want to say the sticks, but pretty much as close as you get to the sticks around here anyways.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in a part of Connecticut that was just in the middle of the woods. And when I moved in with my uncle for a while, it was like a new development area where it was all still woods. Like, you go up this giant, giant hill, and his was the first house. And then there was the road continued, but there was almost no houses. So for a couple of years, from like 11, 12, something like that, like, the hobby would be to just wander through the woods. And I, to this day, I have no idea how I ever found my way back. And I always did. I never got lost. I mean, it was far. We're talking at least a walking mile through the woods, but probably a little more than that. I just, I, I don't know, maybe I got a good sense of direction or something, but it's always a blast.
Yeah, it's always good to have, because you see a lot of these reports of people that get lost on hikes and then, you know, they pass away, and then whenever the, you know, they finally discovered a year or three later, oh, they were just a couple hundred feet off the path. It's like, wow, that's crazy. It's easy to get lost in these dense woods.
That always blows my mind.
Yeah.
Yeah. A couple hundred feet off the path. By the way, sorry, everybody. I guess there's a bit of an audio delay, so we're going to be stepping on each other. But, you know, it happens. If post-pandemic you're not used to this, then, you know, I can't. I don't know what else I could tell you. You know, I remember when I was hiking through those woods, there was a mail truck in the middle of the woods. Middle of the woods. And I, to this day, can't fathom how it got there. And unless maybe a house used to be there or something, and then there was like a dirt road, and then it just kind of all grew up over it, like, you know, the grass and the sticks and stuff. Maybe that's how it did, but that always kind of cracked me up. Like, why is there an old mail truck in the middle of the woods? Like, was it the first time we saw it, we looked in, like, is there going to be a body in there? Like, why, you know, but, you know, just...
Yeah, that's the last thing you want to see is an old body in a mail truck. Yeah.
Yeah, maybe it was some redneck up there that like stole a mail truck and thought he was going to stash it in his backyard or something. Never know.
Yep.
So, did you always grow up in that area, like cornfield-esque?
I grew up in a more rural area. I grew up in West Virginia, so I grew up in more mountainy section, less farmland, more mountainy. And then, you know, by the time I hit my late 20s or so, I moved to southern Ohio, and I've been bouncing around this area. We've been thinking about moving down to the Carolinas at some point, but I don't know if that's going to happen when. But for me, I've always been kind of in the Miami Valley area, you know, West Virginia, Ohio. I've always kind of lived in that area.
Yeah, that's cool. I was down there for the first time in a long time, a couple of months ago, and it's pretty neat. Like, you know, I'm used to the mountains and the hills of Connecticut and New Jersey, and then you get a little farther out west, and it's like you start to understand the difference between a really big hill and a mountain.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Still got some big-ish ones up over here, but not like that. It's always pretty cool. Love cresting the top of one of those in the car, and you come over, and all you just see trees and stuff for miles and miles as you go across.
Yeah, the part I live in and where I live at, it's I don't want to say flat, but it's there's some like little small hills and stuff, but it's for the most part flat. Like you can see the police officers like sitting off the side of the road like 2 miles down the interstate. You know, there's no excuse to get pulled over by one because you saw them coming. Whereas where I grew up in West Virginia, literally you have visibility a couple hundred feet in each direction behind you, in front of you, because it's constantly going up or down or turning left and right. It's kind of like it is up in Massachusetts where there's like really dense hills and mountains. And it's like a cop could bust you out of nowhere because you never saw him coming. You just never had a chance. Whereas here, it's all flat. You can see 3 miles down the road. You can see him waiting on the side of the road. So if you get pulled over by one, you're just not paying attention.
Yeah. Yeah. I used to get a lot of tickets. I haven't in quite a long time. And, you know, obviously not having a car, living in Manhattan certainly helped that, but yeah, I was a kid. It was never could quite go fast enough. And getting a motorcycle, I miss having one so much, but I don't think I could own another one and not ride like that. You know, of course, I love the whole putt-putt-putt around town. You go by the beach, you go by a lake or something. It's really pretty, but 0 to 60 in light speed is more my jam.
I've never been much into motorcycles. My cousins had one, and we went to their a cookout. I was probably like 10 or 12, something like that. And they're like, hey, you want to check out the motorcycle? Cool, get on it. Bam, hit the garage door. Okay, I'm done. That's literally funny. My experience. I hit this garage door, and I was like, yep, I'm good.
The first time I ever got on any kind of dirt bike, motorbike, I was like 16. And I wasn't used to the whole, like, you have to squeeze the clutch and let out really slowly. Which, you know, if you've never done that before, your muscles have never made that motion. So,
yeah,
it was a dirt bike, and I kind of straddled it, and I revved it just a little bit. And then the clutch slipped and it came out from under me, and it's hopping on one wheel and I'm running behind it. But because I'm holding on to the throttle, I had to finally, like, as it's up in the air, let go, grab the throttle again and drop it back down. And all my friends were peeing their pants laughing, like, you moron. I'm like, let me try again. Like, no, absolutely not. Get off of my bike. Leave me alone. So,
yeah, we don't want you to destroy this. Years. Yeah.
Oh, well, at least that was a cheap dirt bike and not somebody's really nice motorcycle.
Yeah.
So how'd you get into all that stuff, all the stuff that we've been doing? Because I remember you just your YouTube channel, Todd's Nerd Cave. And I remember you posted under a few different names on different forums, right? Or was it always one?
No. My names on different forums have kind of evolved over the years, depending on what mood I was in at any given time. As far as like design work and like building things, I don't know. It's kind of always how I've been.
Mm-hmm.
Runs my family. My grandfather was like a woodworker. My brother is a baker. He owns a artisan bakery down in North Carolina. So he's into that kind of stuff. I mean, he's also into like building things and stuff like that, but he's, his hobby really is, bakery stuff. He bakes cookies and cakes and all sorts of stuff. Again, he's, does quite well for himself. As far as me goes with 3D printing and stuff, my first foray into it was, I think it was late 2017, I bought a Robo 3D, R3D, something rather. And if you look at any of my older Todd's Nerd Cave videos, you'll see it. It was a big white thing with a white like shroud over it. It set off on the corner, and it was visible in some of my videos. I didn't really use it a lot. It was kind of unreliable piece of junk. It worked, but it seemed like it was one of those things where every time I needed to use it, it just didn't work. Mm-hmm. Or you had to fiddle about, and you'd get jams in the extruder, and it was just, it was something that, I use, and every time I wanted to use it, I was cussing at it. And I wasn't designing any of my own stuff. I was, just like everybody else, I was downloading things off Thingiverse or other 3D sources, STLs, and printing them. So eventually, I think it was like 2018 or so, 2019, I got rid of that printer. I was having tons of problems with it. It just didn't work. And I didn't think anything else about that stuff at all. And it wasn't until the pandemic kicked in that I started thinking about 3D printing. And I wanted to get into that again. And that's kind of what kickstarted my interest back in 3D printing.
Isn't it funny when you have a piece of equipment that's either terrible or just meh, and then you upgrade to another one, that weird feeling you get of like, it's both exciting, like, oh, this is how it's supposed to work, but it's also frustrating, like, how many fucking hours of my life did I waste on that thing because I didn't know any better at the time? For me, it was the desoldering gun. I must have ruined 3 motherboards with that thing, not realizing that if I had just spent $6 more and gotten the big station one that I've been using forever, that like all of it would work perfect. The first time I used one that wasn't a piece of garbage and I just went and the chip fell out, I was just like, what is going on? This is just like, this is what Jose does. Like, why, how did I not do this? It's kind of funny when you run into that stuff.
Yeah, I'm the same way. You'll buy a piece of equipment and it doesn't work the way you think it's supposed to work, or what the impression in your mind is how it's supposed to work. And then you find out later it's because either you bought the cheap thing or because technology has simply moved along since then. The printers are like that, where, if the Robo 3D I had back then, if you compare it to what you can buy now, just a couple years later, it's a night and day difference in terms of reliability and quality, especially reliability with any of these, especially if you're doing any kind of mass production work. Reliability is a key feature. If you can't keep the thing working, it's useless. It's a useless tool.
Yeah. Yeah. It's always a different emotion when the technology moves forward versus when you realize maybe you weren't educated enough in a subject, or you're just like me and sometimes you're stubborn and you try to force the cheaper solution to work just because. But like, I always get frustrated at myself for those. But when you see technology evolve, that's always kind of just a happy, neat thing. Like even like the last time I used a weed whacker was 15 years ago or something like that. And it was a massive piece of crap. And I just got one for like $100 and I'm like, I can't believe this is $100. This works like 1,000 times better than that piece of junk I used to have. So it's just that kind of stuff makes me happy.
Yeah. And you can buy nice battery powered ones nowadays too. No longer need to put gas in them and dig around with mixing 2-stroke fuel or any of that kind of stuff. You can just rechargeable battery and the thing will run and run and run forever.
Yeah, a lot of my friends bust my chops about that. Like, why wouldn't you just get the gas-powered stuff? And I'm like, when I hit, like, 11, I think, I was obsessed and needed a Sega Genesis. So I was walking around the ghetto asking people if I could mow their lawns, but we were in the ghetto, so it was like a 3-foot by 3-foot patch of lawn. So I'm just walking around block after block with a beat-ass old mower and whatever else, and I just that whole memory of that's like, I think I earned my way past that. I just want to, you know, plug something in, press a button and go. And it just, I'm sure I'm wrong about that. But for my own personal thing, it's like, no, give me the battery stuff. I don't want to hear that. I don't want to smell that anymore. That was years of my childhood just saving up to be able to get stuff. So like,
you know, especially with gas, man, you know, you're pushing your mower around and all of a sudden it dies. You're out of gas. You go back to your can in your garage and you got no fuel. You got to stop, get in the car, go get some fuel, come back. Whereas with the battery ones, as long as you have an extra battery, have it on a charger, pop it out, pop it in.
100%.
Yeah, a minute later, you're up and running.
The only thing I got to say is if, for me personally, at my house, 100% agreed. But if I had like a crew with a bunch of stuff, like how, you know, what if you forgot to charge all your batteries? Whereas what if you forgot to fill up your gas tank? Well, okay, hold on a minute. Take the truck, go fill up your gas tank. 5 minutes later, yeah, you're back at it. Whereas like you can't fast charge, you know, 20 batteries for a crew of people. So that's the one thing that I haven't quite got there yet. So
yeah, if you're doing this commercially, like a service or something, yeah, you, unfortunately gas is still the way to go on it. Cause yeah, you could just have like a 20 gallon tank sitting on the truck. And then when you need it, you just go back and refill. Whereas, yeah, for consumers, for home use, unless you've got like a field, if you've got like a 5 acres of land you're mowing, then yeah, you need a big old riding mower and that's gas. Whereas, yeah, you know, like for example, my property, I think total size of my property is like a third of an acre. And then the house is sitting in the middle of that. So it's not exactly a lot of land. You know, I can take the mower out and I can mow the entire yard and trim it with a weed eater in an hour or less. So for me, electric's perfect. I can usually one battery, one and a half battery. I can just run the whole yard. No big deal. So yeah.
Have you seen those backpack batteries some of the companies came out with now? So it's basically like 10 of their batteries in like a 40-50 pound thing, and you strap it on and it plugs, you know, the plug is like an empty battery from whatever brand it is, and you could just stick it into all the devices, and that way you could go around and, you know, you have like a day's worth of battery power on that. I don't need any of that. My yard's small enough for that. I think it's a half acre or something, but yeah.
So basically it's like a car battery in a backpack.
Basically, yeah. I always thought that was funny. And I saw a couple people, because we got, I mean, thousands and thousands of leaves in the fall over here. So everybody's been hiring. One guy just has a giant ride-on thing where all the leaves go into the big bales. But most people just hire services to come. And here's my dumbass with a battery-powered blower. Like, I hate every one of you, especially the neighbor that doesn't actually clean their leaves. And they all blow on my lawn every time the wind goes on. So
I got the neighbors that don't mow the grass. You know, they'll mow it like 3 times a year.
Oh, geez.
Like, you know, beginning of summer, middle summer, end of summer. No, they've gotten better. It was like the first year because this whole development's fairly new. So all the houses on this street's like the oldest house on the street's like 4 years old. So, you know, most people were letting for the first couple of years, letting their grass kind of grow in. Cause you know, when you have a brand new yard, especially if it's not sod, it's actually seeded with hay and seed. It takes quite a while before the grass starts growing in. So you'd see these people, these yards that look kind of ghetto-rific, but it's just because they're letting them grow in. So you'd have people with grass, like up to the part of the yard would have grass up to your knee. Other part of the yard would look like a desert. And it just, you know, matters. It looks janky though. It looks like half the yard's dead when it just hasn't grown in yet.
That's funny. Yeah, I got a bunch of patches in mine and I've been trying to seed it. And I'm like, I like doing stuff like that, but there's just some things where I'm like, man, I don't have the desire to do it. Like waking up every morning and going out and watering the lawn. It's like, any of the heavy lifting, cool. I enjoy that stuff, but I just couldn't imagine me being the guy that just goes outside and just stands there, you know? And yeah, you could put the sprinkler stuff in and all that, but the yard's not big enough or important enough. My goal in this is to just be invisible. I want my house to be nice enough where none of the neighbors ever bother me. They just leave me alone. You know, I'm not the guy with the loud music or the big lawn. Mm-hmm. I'm not the over ornate one. Just leave me be.
Yeah.
Well, so back to your YouTube channel though. When did you actually start that? Because around the time I was on YouTube, I remember seeing a couple of your videos anyway.
I think the oldest videos that are currently on there probably go back to like, I don't know, 2012, 2013, but it was more of just a random, like, you know, a lot of people used to use YouTube, but they would just throw up a random video or something. There was no coherent, plan to what they were doing. You know, it was just kind of randomness. And then somewhere around 2015 or so, I actually started creating content with some sort of purpose. It was still a hobby. It always was a hobby for me. There was never any kind of intention for anything beyond, you know, an artistic hobby. You know, it was like, I wanted to put up a video, put some time into, you know, creating the video, editing and filming it. And I mean, I lost a ton of money as far from a camera gear standpoint, as far as that channel permanently stayed in the red. It was constant. It was from day one until now, it was always in the red, but I never looked at it from that point. I always looked at it as a hobby. You know, I'd go out and buy something, or I'd create something, or I'd look at something. And I thought, okay, I want to make a video on this. There was never anything beyond that. That was the limitation for me as far as the purpose of that channel. It was simply my own entertainment. When it came down to it, it was really for my own artistic entertainment than it was with anything else. I want to get back to it eventually.
It's funny when you cross that line of like wanting to do videos versus having to do videos. Like I get kind of obsessive. So like it was all, if I decided to do it, it's the same amount of effort. I wish I could dial it back. I don't have that. But you're right. When I first started YouTube, it was like, okay, I can embed a bunch of pictures on the website, and I could embed some audio files, but I can't really do that with a video that well. So, I guess I'll just use YouTube. And that's kind of where it started. I think one of my first videos was just simply showing Duck Hunt on an RGB monitor, because one of the main questions back then, before people really knew what this was, is will light guns work on an RGB monitor? Uh-huh. I asked that myself when I first started getting into it. So that was it. My first video was just shooting ducks.
I think my very first video would have been, I know the oldest video I think on my channel now was showing off a Thecus NAS network attached storage device that I'd bought and put some drives in. It was more of a just, you know, kind of follow along with me, not really a tutorial, just more of a random, you know, kind of video. I think there might have been a video too before that, but it definitely fell into the random shit category, you know, just there was no clear, just, there's some random shit. But I tried to actually, after that, I tried to focus and try to bring some sort of narrative to the purpose of the whole channel, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know, it worked. I liked your videos, so.
I mean, for me, it was always, I always looked at the YouTube stuff as stuff I wanted to do rather than, have to do, as you mentioned. You know, I never, for me, it was never going to be a job. Never, there was times where I felt like, man, I haven't uploaded a video in like 6 months. Maybe I should make something. You know, and it's like, I kind of look around my office and I'm like, I used to keep in my old house, I used to keep on the wall a whiteboard where I'd write down ideas. And I swear to God, I never went back and marked through any of them because I never actually filled any of those damn things. But it was how I used to try to stay focused. And every once in a while, I look at that and go, yeah, I haven't done any of those. And then another idea would pop up. I swear to God, I've got like a mountain of script ideas. I've got a ton of scripts I wrote out for videos, which maybe one of these days I'll get around to doing some of them. But it's like, it always for me was some, I had to want to do it, not feel like I need to do it.
Hmm.
Yeah, so that's how for me, the YouTube stuff, you know, kind of took a back seat once I started getting into some of this stuff. And it's just like, that's a lot, you know, for me, it was a lot, it's a huge time sink. And I don't think people, I don't think people realize, you know, if you put out a 5-minute video, we'll just say you put out a 5-minute video, like how much time goes into behind the scenes on creating that video. I mean, it's a tremendous amount of time, just from script writing, research, setting up the scene before you even edit it, just getting to the point where you can edit it, you know, you're looking at a tremendous amount of time. And then once you go into edit, depending on how your workflow is, that's allowed to be double or triple what time you spent before. So it's, you know, for example, my channel, I used to look at it this way. Whenever I published a video, you know, I would like for every 1 minute of finished video, there'd be at least 1 to 2 hours worth of work put into 1 minute of finished video at least. And it depends, you know, if you have a video with a whole bunch of captured footage, obviously that metric slides down. But if it's a bunch of B-roll, voiceovers, and other scripted stuff, then that time scale goes up. So, but I used to look at it that way. That was my ballpark, was 1 to 2 hours per every minute of finished video. So if you look at my channel, you don't see a whole lot of 10-minute plus videos because that's a lot of damn time. And if you're doing this part-time as just a side hobby, it's like, yeah, I'm not putting 30 hours into a video with the way I like to do them that way. It's like, I just can't do that.
Yeah, I remember putting off making videos for as long as possible. And I remember just trying to find excuses not to make them. And I was talking to Corey from My Life in Gaming, like, so how long does it actually take you to edit these? Like, is it like an hour a minute? Or he's like, well, you can't really put a time on it. He's like, it sometimes can be a lot longer than that. And I'm like, oh man, I don't have time for this, but I do like it. The only time it ever feels like work is when it's stuff that I just don't want to do a video on at all, but I feel like I have to. And that's rare. That's like the Intech Gaming Game Boy Advance bullshit. I was just like, I didn't want to do that video. I knew exactly what was going to happen. I knew they were going to come after me. I knew the bottom feeders were going to come after me just because of that age old, like, well, I'll go against the narrative for attention. Fucking losers. I knew it was going to happen. I knew it. But I was like, nobody else is talking about all the things that are really wrong with it, so I have to. And the whole time, I was just swearing through the whole thing, like, I fucking hate this thing. I hate that I'm doing this. There's like three really awesome projects that I wanted to promote. I want to be the happy, jolly, fat guy drinking beer and high-fiving people. I don't want to be the finger-waving lag guy, but if no one else does it, I guess I got to do it. So
yeah, I mean, I think the difference there is you didn't want to do it. You didn't really need to do it, but you needed to do it. You know what I mean? You know, it needed to be done. Yeah, you didn't have to do it, but it needed to be done because, like you said, if you don't do it, you're just going to get a bunch of people with bullshit rubber stamping. And yeah, it displays on your TV. Yeah, there's more to it than that, but that, it does, in fact, do that.
I'm not the fat guy Gotham wants. I'm the fat guy Gotham needs.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, yeah, you didn't want to do it, but you had to kind of do it because otherwise you're going to get a bunch of people bullshit. But then again, there was a bunch of videos early on, other people saying, yeah, man, this thing has got some issues, like the lack of proper aspect ratio. Like, how basic of a thing can you fuck up? When I see a retro gaming device that has a 4x3 and 16x9 switch on, I already know it's bullshit. I already know, you know, when I see almost anything like a Hyperkin, you know, 4x3, 16x9, I'm like, I know you guys just don't give a damn. It's like when I start seeing aspect ratio switches on the side, a physical switch, I know you got bullshit in there. It's like it just, my spidey senses have already kicked off. My bullshit meters are kicked off. You guys are full of shit. It's like you can't even get aspect ratio correct. So it's, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, just for the record, there was a bunch of other very good reviews. It's just they tried to take the positive stance. And while they told all of the bad things wrong with it, you know, I think everybody was like, all right, well, it's up to you then to go up against them, because I don't think anybody wants to deal with the stuff that comes with it. And it's, you know, it's fine. If I got to do it, I'll do it. But that's annoying. And at least Intech isn't like Kaiko. Because Intech will just come up with some bullshit thing. They'll have like a drama channel or two, do a video about how it's actually a good product. But Kaiko is like legit come after me saying that I was lying. And every time I'll just post screenshots of their own emails and then they disappear for a couple months. And then they come back and like, that Bob guy's lying. We never did that. Like, it's the same screenshot from last time, you morons. He's like, yeah, it's a... That's not the kind of drama I like. The kind of drama I like is when Voltar and I start making fun of each other. That's what I enjoy. That makes me happy. Not the real crap.
Yeah, I don't blame you, because I don't understand why these guys can't just... It's the same people complaining about the same things every time. In my mind, they would come to someone like you or Voltar. They come to somebody in the industry and say, hey, here's a product. Where can we improve? Okay, cool. And then put up. Instead of, no, we just throw out a product. And then you have to listen to you guys bitch about it over and over and over. It's the same thing. It's like, are you guys not getting the clue here? Like, seriously, it's like, how many times do you need to keep cutting out the same bullshit stuff with the same issues?
Well, but if they keep getting their projects funded, why would they listen? Why would they spend an extra penny or an extra minute doing anything different if their projects still get funded? So
has their Game Boy Advance thing been funded? Has it reached that yet?
No, but there's like 3 weeks left. So my guess is it's definitely getting funded, no doubt whatsoever.
It'll probably just kind of squeak by, it sounds like.
Just like the Warrior, barely squeaked by.
Yeah, the Warrior's interesting because I never, you know, I know the case is a personal aesthetic thing. You know, some people only like it, some people don't care. That's, you know, mine was always, you know, on the video side. And I remember, you remember the original Kickstarter, the original stuff they were promoting on it was, oh, here it is compared to the Ultra HDMI. And they compared, you know, they showed videos and stuff. It's like, wow, that looks pretty good. And then once we find out reality from you, it's like, holy shit, these guys are shit. You know,
and then they sent a couple free ones to a drama channel and had them make a video saying that I lied about the video boards for attention, that those were pre-production video boards and people would not be getting those. And that's why I did that follow-up post with showing that not only were people getting the exact same chips, and by the way, thank you to everybody who posted a picture of that, but they also continued to send out sandpaper with the first couple hundred units that were already boxed up. Because remember that too, they were the one that said, if you have problems with your games, take some sandpaper and say, like, are you serious? Are you, you know, that's exactly like saying, you know, if you're not quite sure if your, you know, light socket's working, lick your finger and stick it in there to see if you get buzz. Cause, you know, like that stuff cracked me up. But
I understand why they included sandpaper, but I don't understand why they felt they needed to include the sandpaper. Like, how's it their job to make sure the games are clean? I mean, that makes no sense. Why would you even do that?
You know the messed up part? If they just came out with the shell and nothing else. I thought the shell was awesome. A lot of people didn't. So opinion, just like you said, it's only an opinion. I loved it. I thought it was cool as hell. If they just released that shell, I would have been promoting the ever-living shit out of that campaign. Like, do you have a broken N64 shell? Here you go. Do you like this better? Sell your mint condition shell to somebody who needs it. Everybody wins. Same thing with the Game Boy Advance controller thingy. That's not the most comfortable controller in the world, but I guarantee you people would probably want to use that for a couple of different uses. So even with Mister and a controller adapter or something, if you're so good at one thing and you're so shit at the other, why would you still do that? Why wouldn't you just stick to the thing that you're good at and have everybody love you for it? I don't get it. Maybe
They seem to be pretty good at the plastic side of thing, but when it comes to the everything else, anything inside the plastic, that's when they seem to falter and then they want to blame everybody else. But I think it's comical them claiming that the pre-production board is like, well, why do you send it out then? If you send out a product to a reviewer and it's crappy and then later you come back and say, oh no, that was pre-prototype, pre-beta, whatever. It's like, you still sent that out.
They didn't send it to me. They sent it to Metal Jesus, who sent it to me, and he sent me all of the information they gave him as well. So that, I think that's what they were trying to say something like that, but no, Jason didn't lie in the slightest. He never does. He's just open and honest. You know, no one's ever right 100% of the time, but he's not a liar. Neither am I. I'm a lot of things, but I'm not a liar. So, it's whatever. You know, I guess the other reason stuff like that sticks out so much is because if you take that in contrast to all the other awesome things that are out there. And, you know, everything from Mike's RetroTINK 5X and then 2.0 firmware that everybody got for free. Like, you put that in context of it. But even little shit, like when you did the feet for the AESs. Like, that was one of those things where I was like, I absolutely need one of these in the controller stick. Like, you found those. A lot of the little stuff you did was just like, this is such an awesome little help. Like, even though it's not an expensive thing, like there's so many cool things like that out there, so that's why the bad ones really tend to stick out and stink.
Yeah.
So where did you get the knowledge to start designing some of the 3D printed stuff that you did? Just kind of learn on your own, trial and error?
For me, the kind of origin of this would be like, you know, I picked up another printer in 2020. Mid-2020. I mean, to be honest, I have to give most of my credit to Greg Collins, Laser Bear, because that's what got me back into 3D printing, because he published a lot of his designs open source or free to download. So, you know, when I got back into 3D printing in 2020, first thing I downloaded once I figured out how to get back into the printer calibrated, one of the first things I downloaded was his GC loader stuff, his GC loader mount. And his side fan replacement for the 50mm fan. And I'm not sure if you want like an origin story on some of this stuff, like how I got into this.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so I downloaded his GC loader mount, beautiful, great design. I downloaded his replacement fan shroud for the side of the GameCube, which uses that, I think it's a noise blocker 50mm fan. And I downloaded, printed both of them, installed them. I went to, I think, Amazon and bought the noise blocker fan and saw it. I got up and running. Wow. Then, I was like, this works great. I still didn't have any interest in designing stuff myself, but I was mostly still just consuming. I was downloading, printing, and, I installed it, worked great. And I had my GameCube sitting off on one of my side disks running for a couple hours. I think it was going through the Soul Calibur 2, the track mode, the demo where it just keeps rolling the track mode. And after about 3 hours, I'm sitting here and all of a sudden, the cube's just powered off. And I was like, that's weird. I thought maybe it was like a, you know, like some of these consoles will have like a power off, where after so many hours will power off, or like, I didn't know if maybe Swiss or something had a mode, like I didn't know. So I reached over to turn the cube back on, and it was burning hot. I mean, like, we're talking like freaking inferno. Like, it felt like you're putting your hands on a furnace. Trust me, the GameCube can get hot like that, and it's because the fan failed. And so I took the cube back apart and fiddled with the fan, tested the fan outside the cube. That fan was dead as a doorknob, 3 hours old. It literally ran for 3 hours and just died. And I was like, man, that sucks. So I went back to Amazon, looked through some reviews, and saw some other people complaining that it either worked really great or it failed pretty quick. I guess those things have a pretty early, was it, infile, early birth defect thing, you know, like you know how electronics are. Either they work forever or they'll fail right away. It's that's usually how it works. Infant mortality type thing. So I thought I want to replace this fan. And there's not a lot of good other 50 millimeter fans that are quiet out there. So I thought, okay, maybe I can kind of botch up my own design, you know. So I started with Tinkercad. And Tinkercad, if you have no CAD experience, is great because it's kind of Lego blocks. You can kind of place things. It's basically Lego blocks. And over the course of a couple of days, I knocked out a 40 millimeter Noctua fan mount that was designed to go into the original fan shroud. And I was pretty proud of myself. And, you know, I threw it up on Thingiverse and posted on Twitter. And everybody's like, hey, cool, you know, cool, different option. And that's what I thought. I was like, I've installed it. And I tested that fan in that GameCube for days. Literally, I turned on the GameCube, turned off the TV or the monitor, and walked away from it. I let that thing run for days testing thermals on that thing. So I knew that, A, the Noctua fan would be suitable, and B, that it wasn't going to melt down the GameCube. And everything at this point was fine. I didn't really give any more thought to anything beyond that. I got a comment about 2 weeks after I posted on Thingiverse, and the comment was, I sell on eBay. That was the entire comment. I was like, what? I sell on eBay. That was the entire comment.
Oh, that they're telling you that they're selling your design on eBay.
Yeah, but the way it was worded, I was like, what? So I go to eBay, I can't find it. I'm like, I don't know what the hell they're talking about. And then I start thinking, I bet this is eBay UK. Because that kind of broken English. Sure enough, I go to eBay.UK, and there was some guy selling my design. Two guys, actually, selling my GameCube mount. And not only did they sell them, according to eBay, they sold like 60 of these things in 2 weeks. I'm like, what the hell? Oh, I was so pissed. I mean, I guess in reality, when you upload something like that, that's what's going to happen. But at the time, I was furious because I was like, I gave this away for free. I mean, I don't have a problem with someone printing something like this on demand. Like, but whenever you bulk print them and then offer them for sale, that's a totally different category of things. That's a totally different thing. So I was so pissed. I was like, if he can sell them, I can sell them too. That's what started RetroFrog.
That's awesome.
But I realized pretty quickly within the first couple of weeks, before I officially launched RetroFrog, which was middle of December of 2020, I realized that I was going to need to come up with other designs because obviously I can't run a shop with a single design. And I also realized that Tinkercad wasn't going to get me too far. I mean, I've seen some people do some absolutely amazing things in Tinkercad. Like, Steph, you look at the final design, like, damn, you did that in Tinkercad? But the problem is they spent a shit ton of time in Tinkercad doing that because it doesn't have the tools to automatically do this stuff. You've got to manually manipulate stuff. And, you know, like, for example, if you want a rounded fillet edge, that's not an option in Tinkercad. So you've got to go in there and manually create that using other shapes. Or if you want a chamfer or just basic stuff that's like a two clicks in other, you know, in other CAD programs, this one, you've got to manually do that stuff. So I decided on Fusion 360. And then that's when I started kind of working up designs. And to be honest, I find it pretty easy to pick up and learn. And it's just a matter of after that, once you start, you know, you start kind of playing in there, and you run to a roadblock, go to YouTube. Yeah, you know, there's a mountain of tutorials and knowledge out there for that stuff.
That's pretty awesome. How'd you come up with the name RetroFrog?
The frog part is a play off of Todd Toad. When I was a kid, Toad, yeah. And I thought Retro Toad sucked, so I thought RetroFrog. RetroFrog was a better fit.
I think RetroFrog is a better name, but Retro Toad isn't terrible. So
yeah, that's where the frog part of that came from, was a playoff of Toad.
That's pretty funny. Yeah, I mean, the stuff you've been working on is great, and it's kind of cool to see people being able to grow in the scene, and it's especially cool to be able to see people grow like with each other without stealing each other's designs and selling them on eBay, which, you know, on the one hand, right, it's up on Thingiverse, so it's public domain at that point. Like, you can't really fight anything at that. So it's, you know, once you put it up there, it's everybody's going to do whatever they want with it, and you can't stop them. But, you know, the other side of that is there's still ways to do that growing together, not, you know, not a middle finger in the air, I sell on eBay. So,
yeah, I think for me, the biggest part is lack of attribution. Because, you know, the license specifically says, you know, you have to attribute it. And depending on what license you pick, there's some other things in place. But for me, you know, I don't care as much that you now that you're selling on eBay or Etsy or whatever, is the fact that you don't even attribute the design to the original creator. And there's a guy on Etsy. There's a guy on Etsy that's took a couple of my designs, my GameCube fan mount, the GC video brace that you originally suggested. He took these designs from me. I know he did because they came from me. Made some slight cosmetic modifications. And he sells them on Etsy and eBay with absolutely no attributing the original design. And that's like, I hate that. That's what pisses me off. People that won't tell you where it came from, who originally designed it, what was the inspiration. And it's like, it's a dick move. You know, that's what really pisses me off when you don't attribute where it came from. You know, I don't expect you to cut me in on the deal. That's fine. But you at least tell people, you know, this is based off of another design. I think it's the least you can do, in my opinion.
Agree more. That's a very sore spot for me. There's been a couple of YouTubers that are much bigger than a lot of ever be that basically just read my page out loud. And some of them end with, and if you want more info, check it out on RetroRGB. And I'm like, oh, that's awesome. Thank you. I appreciate it. Let me retweet you. I'll see what else you got. Maybe I could help out with something. And then there's other people that read the entire page as if they were the one that did the research, as if they were the one that put the 40, 50 hours worth of work in, and then it never credit me at all. And then as soon as anybody, it's the same pattern with all these people. As soon as somebody calls them out, like, you know, that was Bob's post from 3 weeks ago, right? They block everybody. Like, delete, block, mute. It's so funny to see those people come out, but it's frustrating because it's very little effort to do it in a way where you'll make friends versus piss people off. Very, very little effort.
Yeah, I think it's really bad with YouTube because, you know, you see these guys that if you watch their channels, they don't put a lot of effort into the video side of things. So they go out and they just take clips of videos from other people, or they'll take gameplay footage from GameSack or something like that, or from My Life in Gaming or anybody else, and then they never attribute where it came from. And yeah, I've seen Joe from GameSack call people out on Twitter about that stuff. You know, like he'll be like, you know, here's a clip from your video, here's a clip from mine. It's the same damn footage, and you never bothered to mention where it came from. You know,
there was a couple of years ago, a whole bunch of people who were spreading false information about copyright strikes and who are saying people who do that are evil. And Joe and I were the only ones who really stood up against that. And we both took a lot of shit. And it's kind of frustrating because we were both right. And I know I was right, not because I'm a know-it-all, but because I had just had an entire 2-hour meeting with a lawyer about something completely and totally different or unrelated, but the same exact type of subject. And it was just one of those things where it was like, I know exactly what I'm talking about because people way smarter than these Twitter warriors have just explained this to me. And everybody was like, no, you're wrong. Somebody even stole footage of me holding up a time sleuth to a CRT where I demonstrated, like, this is what zero lag is. They took footage of me personally, put it in their video, and said that, and people tend to exaggerate lag. You don't have to worry. As if I was saying that 3 microseconds of lag is bad, when in my video I was actually saying, like, here's what zero lag is. And apparently they did it just to show Bob that that's not how copyright strikes and fair use works. And it's like, no, I could absolutely sue you for that. And I can get the video taken down, and I can get whatever money that you had from that video sent to me, which will be about 1/1000th of what it would cost for me to do that, which is why I would never do that. So it's not worth my time anyway, but just because I wouldn't waste my time doing it doesn't mean it's not illegal. That shit cracks me up. I don't know, but I guess I'm a little frustrated today too. Just to warn everybody, I just wasted like 8 hours on a PC problem and I still don't know what it is, but I just, and I wasted some of my friends' times too. So I'm a little grumpy today, not at Todd. But so yeah, if you hear me a little bit pissy in my voice, it's just because I'm mad at my computer.
did you reboot it though?
Yeah, I even reinstalled Windows and swapped hardware around, and I'm chasing down a 4K 60 frame drop bug, and I got a newer computer with an i9 in it, so and a 3060 graphics card. So yeah,
just you need to buy a Mac, man. Just dump that junk PC hardware. Get yourself a Mac.
Was able to get a MacBook last June, so I have a MacBook for my laptop. I have a Windows PC and now a Linux server, so I'm trying to up my Mac and Linux game. And
there you go.
Linux is confusing because if you know DOS, it's actually worse than if you didn't know anything at all, because you go, you know, I'm confusing Linux commands and DOS commands, and yeah, my friends have been very patient with me on that one. So I apologize.
Why doesn't DIR friends. Work?
Right.
So. Yeah,
that's my day job. Sudo. Yeah, sudo, but I didn't even know how you pronounce it until like a month ago. Yeah. Oh well. Well. So what? You know, what's the plan going forward? Right? Because you know, you had your YouTube channel as a hobby. Now, I guess Retro Frog's also a hobby, but that's going to be keeping you busy because you got a lot of orders going through, right?
Yeah. I'm eventually hoping to grow it to the point where it's my primary job. Cause right now it's just a secondary, man. I wouldn't say it's a hobby. It's grown past hobby land. You know, I spend as much, if not more on it than I do my day job. So for me, it's like, it's grown beyond hobby. It's got to the point, it's took on its own thing. So I'm hoping eventually that I can grow it to the point where I can walk away from my day job and I can just concentrate on Retro Frog stuff, but that's going to be a ways out, but man, who knows? We'll see.
Yeah. But I mean, if you're set up to do this, you know, I've always told developers who say they're going to try to sell their own stuff. Like, just because you're really good at designing these boards and getting these things done and getting them all made doesn't mean that you should you're going to be good at selling and supporting. And even if you are, is that how you want to spend your time? And most people listen. There's always the stubborn people that need to learn the hard way, but which I'm one of them many times, so I'm not talking shit, but those are the people that I always like to pass on to different companies. And it's like, if you're looking to do this full time, you know, why don't you take on getting the PCBs made? You make the cases yourself, you know, and it starts small so you can still do it while you're with your day jobs. That's why kind of my middlemaning is trying to put everybody in touch with each other for stuff like that. And I'm pretty sure I've reached out to you about 3D print designs too for, you know, smaller projects. And I try to be smart about it. I'm not going to be like, all right, Todd, I need 10,000 of these by the end of next week. Like, you know, realistic, right? This is your side job. So something that's fitting, you know, bigger projects, yeah. I would send to Greg because he's got his 3D printing farm. Massive projects, I would get injection molded. So it's, you know, I think there's room for everybody, to be honest.
Yeah. I mean, I've got a couple of projects lined up with some PCBs and stuff, and some of the smaller stuff I hand assemble, but eventually you reach a wall where that's just not realistic. You can't scale it, you know, because when the limiting factor is you, then you're the limiting factor. So realistically, if you want to scale it, you know, you've got to move it beyond yourself. And obviously from a hobby business like this, the financial stake on doing something like, obviously something you have to kind of think about before you take it on. Cause I've got a couple other things coming up that will require custom PCBs. And these PCBs are totally something that could be built by a build shop. You know, there's nothing weird or fancy about them, nothing that makes it impossible to be built from a factory. It just comes down to time and money. I think time is always my biggest enemy, finding the time to do everything.
Yeah, mine too. That's, you know, it's always time and money are the two things. And it's like, it's so frustrating how, you know, trying to figure out what to spend your time on. And, you know, it's especially frustrating when you waste a day on a stupid PC problem that I probably should have been smart enough to figure out anyway. But, you know, it's time is always the biggest issue. So that's something we all have to figure out, I guess.
Yep.
So, I mean, we can't, you know, there's no way I can't ask about Terror Onion because I get trolled enough in the comments as it is. But, you know, I understand you're in a place because, yeah, you know, there's still there's still a lot more going on. They have good products. You know, there's a good group of people that support those products. But so how did, like, what's the short version, at least? Like, how'd you get started with Terra Onion at all? How did you deal with the frustrations of certain assholes who were a little bit upset about how certain things were handled? And then, you know, what was the graceful exit? Because it was a graceful exit. There was no shit talk, mud flinging. It was, you know, it was polite. It was professional.
I guess I'll address how I got started with them. Okay. They, when they originally came on the scene, it was late 2016 with the original NeoSD. I think it was late 2016 with the original, NeoSD cartridge.
Sounds about right.
They were still just known as the NeoSD team. They hadn't took on the Terra Onion name. I remember just out of the blue, these guys popped on the scene, like literally out of nowhere. These guys popped on the scene, Alex and NeoDev, with their NeoSD cartridge. And I ordered one because at the time, you know, they weren't a very big company, so a lot of people weren't willing to take a risk. I mean, I have no idea the original NeoSD cartridges they sold, but I was one of the first people to buy one of the MVS NeoSDs. Mm-hmm. And if you look at my channel, you'll find a video of it. I spoke very positively of it. It was a great cartridge, especially considering at the time what your options were. You know, Darksoft, yeah, he was nowhere close to having his cartridge out. His cartridge was another year and a half. It was way down the road. The Terra Onion beat him to the punch way, way, way ahead of time. And your only other options were like the banana card, the yellow card, which has got all sorts of issues.
Yeah, which back then were terrible. You know, the people who make those have been listening because they've fixed a bunch of the really dangerous things wrong with it. But yeah, back then that was really the only option, and it was a bad one.
Yeah, and there was a couple other flash cards. They were all different sides of the exact same coin. Yeah, you had limited amount of games on them. There was a whole lot of beta buggy versions, and then just overall, they were ticking time bombs. I mean, you don't know how long those things were going to last. So, anyways, I bought one, reviewed it, spoke positively of it. That's that. It was sometime shortly after Alex reached out to me about wanting to create a video for them, like a promotional video. I didn't understand at the time what he was actually asking, because if you spoke to Alex, you know, his English is not his first language. A lot of people give him shit about things he says in English. And whilst, yeah, a lot of times he's being sarcastic or being mean about stuff. The reality is, I think he honestly is a good guy. However, when a language is not your native one, sometimes things get lost in translation. So whenever I was reading his original emails about creating this promotional video, I misconstrued it as something he wanted me to post on my channel. And I was like, no, I don't do that. You know, I've made a review video. I'm not creating like a whatever you're looking for. It wasn't until later on that I went back to his emails and realized what he was actually asking for. He was looking for, I don't want to say commercial, but he was looking for just kind of a, you know, plus and benefits type thing, kind of commercial, like just something like an advertisement type thing that he wanted to post through Terra Onion's own social media and YouTube. So time went by, and I remember whenever they announced the original Super SD System 3, I reached out to Alex again saying, hey, I know we didn't kind of click and connect on the original NeoSD video you want to do, but can I do something for you there? And he sent me some video and clips and stuff, and I created a couple things for him, which if you look on Terra Onion's website, on their YouTube, you'll find some of the promo stuff I did for him. And then he sent me one of the original Super SD System 3s. And like everybody else, the first 100, we know there was problems with that thing. There was video and audio problems with that. And I remember whenever I got my original first unit, because I was within that first batch of the first 100 they sent out, I was like, yeah, man, this thing's got issues. Like, you know, you've got to, and he and I had a bit of a talk, come to Jesus kind of moment. I'm like, look, you can just roll with this as is. You can totally do that. Or you can recall these things and fix the issue and send out replacements. And as we know, the replacements still had issues. It was better than the first batch, but there was still issues. What eventually led me to working with Terra Onion, I joined them in the fall of 2018. What led me to working with them was on Twitter, Voltar and Alex got into it.
Voltar gets into it with everybody.
Yeah, they got into it bad. And I remember coming to Alex, I was like, dude, you can't do this on social media. You know, this thing's, you know, you can't do that. This is going to make you look like an ass. You just can't do this. And he's like, well, what do you recommend? I said, you need to hire somebody. You know, you need to hire somebody to do this stuff. And then that's when he and I talked and I eventually decided to come on. For me, it was, you know, I did social media stuff. I did customer support for technical support, which is its own set of issues. But I did that. If you look on their channel, I did video production on their products and updates and stuff. I did video production on that stuff and announcements, along with doing stuff like the forum, which we ended up shutting down, then Discord. That's all stuff I created. So yeah, that's kind of how I got involved with Terra Onion.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head. I think, you know, Alex is pretty abrasive, but I think his biggest problem, and it's easy for me to say this at arm's length, so I'm probably talking out of turn here, but I think he thinks his English is great, and his English is shit. And I think that is a huge, huge communication issue, because there's been so many times where I've had conversations with people around the planet, and for long, even before Retro RGB, when I had that job where I was traveling around, whenever they start a conversation with, I think my English might be poor, so please be patient. Something falls out of their mouth where if they didn't say that, my reaction would have been, what the fuck did you just say? Like, why would you say that? But because they warned me, I'd kind of say, well, what did you mean by that? Because that could mean a few things. And then they take a pause and they re-explain it. And most of the time, they didn't mean anything even remotely negative at all. It's always the same stupid analogy, but it's so accurate. Like if I was like, yeah, man, I love Retro Frog products, they're the shit. Or if I said Retro Frog products are shit. It is a funny slang compliment versus huge slander for one word. And it's so hard. It's so hard for anybody speaking a different language to grasp that after a while. But it has to start with just like knowing that you're not good at it. So even like the last couple of things that happened online, I was just like, man, I don't know Alex that well, but I'm pretty sure that's not what he meant to say at all. And it still was kind of rude and mean. Not the time for it, but I don't think that's what he meant. I think it just came out wrong, and it sucked to see that. The thing that always bothers me with stuff like that is like when the character Lord Voltar goes on his rants, right? Like that's part of what that is. But when you see that coming from a company social media, that reflects on Miguel, who's always been so nice to me. I always appreciate your patience. Thank you. And anybody else that was involved in that. And it's like, oh man, that sucks for everybody. That shouldn't have happened.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you don't have to worry about it. Not your problem.
So. Yeah. I mean, I guess because, you know, people will obviously ask why I left, and ultimately it came down to dedicating time to my own business. You know, I could either spend that time working with somebody else to grow their business, or I could spend that time working to grow my own business. And you know, I thought I was being kind of underutilized. So I decided I wanted to go my own way.
So. Yeah, but you went your own way building unique products that were either completely separate or went along with and supported Terra Audience stuff. So it's not like you walked away with your middle finger in the air and a Sega CD ODE in your other hand. Like, no, you're doing your own completely different thing. It doesn't step on anybody's toes. And I think that's probably why it was such a cordial, at least publicly, such a cordial separation, because, you know, there was nobody did anything vicious. It was just time for you to do your own thing, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I knew eventually I'd run into a situation where there was going to be a conflict of interest. Mm-hmm. You know, doing what I do, that eventually I'd either want to develop an add-on for a competitor's product or something that did something with a competitor's product, or maybe something I put out competed with something Terra Onion was either currently doing or wanted to do in the future. So it came down to, you know, eventually I knew I was going to have to part ways. Eventually.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, props to all of you for doing it professionally. You know, there was no, you know, some of the most embarrassing things is if you're like you follow bands and you see the band meltdown and everything goes down publicly. Like, I don't know if you know the band Queensryche, but that was one of the most embarrassing things I've ever seen, where I was just like, I'm sure in that moment that felt so important to them, but I could only imagine what it would be like looking back if you were one of those band members, like, I can't believe I did that on stage at a festival in front of all those people just because I was mad at the singer. So, yeah, it's always good to see people at least just do it right in public.
Yeah, and I mean, Terror Onions, I wish those guys the best. They've got a lot of great ideas. But like, like anybody else right now, the chip shortage is just crushing everybody. Anybody that wants to produce anything right now, you can't buy anything. You're either on an ungodly lead time or you're paying out the wazoo for stuff that makes it totally impractical to provide. I mean, if you have a component in a design that used to cost $3 and now costs $30, or used to cost $10 and now costs $150, that you can't produce like that, because you can't raise the price. Nobody's going to buy it. It comes down to that. So yeah, basically they're in a situation like everybody else where they can't produce what they want to produce, and they're just kind of sidelining things, sitting on their thumbs until they can.
Yeah, but it's not just an FPGA shortage. Like, I went to go make something that I've been using for years. Actually, I have them right here because I wanted to solder the rest apart. But there is a resistor, one little transistor thingy, a capacitor, and an LED, and all three are out of stock everywhere. Obviously, for resistors and capacitors, you just find a different brand. But like, I've ordered those maybe 5 times over the past 6 or 7 years, using the same links and the same everything else. And this is the first time ever that I went to order it and not a single part was in stock of 4 of the most basic ass parts you could ever imagine. So it was it's rough these days making anything.
Yeah, all this stuff is, there was something here a while back I was ordering for RetroFrog. It was the same way. I'd ordered multiple times, and I went back to my normal supplier, and it was like, out of stock. And it was like, the lead time, 56 weeks. I'm like, 56 weeks? That ain't going to work. So then you go to another supplier, and you find it in stock, and you have to start making changes to accommodate the difference. But yeah, it's the reality we live in right now, where major components are impossible. Cheaper common passive components, you've got to find alternates for, mm-hmm. or find separate sellers to be able to provide it for, make design changes.
Yeah. And even getting things made in an assembly plant too, like the orders I've been placing with JLC PCB, the part of their thing is if they run out of components, they just send it to you, especially the cheap ones that are like 2 cents each, like a resistor or something. They'll send you the design, but it'll just be missing those parts. And like, one of the things you showed up missing ferrite beads. I'm like, why? Well, it's like 4 cents worth of stuff total, not even per board, but it's like,
yeah,
damn, like that's how bad it is that they didn't even have ferrite beads laying around. So,
yeah, because how's your experience been with them for assembly on stuff?
None of those places are perfect, but they've been top tier compared to a lot of the other stuff I've gone through. I probably had a couple of minor issues over the years. One issue, I don't know if it was their board or the design. We never really figured out what the heck happened with that one. So I just threw that up in the air as it could have been anything. But I've had some pretty bad, I've had stuff come from other competitors of theirs where ground was bridged to a couple of the power traces. And this is a board that I'd ordered multiple times with the same Gerber file in the same folder on my hard drive. So it's not like one of us made a mistake and dragged the traces together. So, and I've never had anything that major. So because I have a history of product manufacturing and the companies that I worked with before I started doing retro RGB full time, I have a very clear expectation of what could go wrong with this stuff. So they're definitely, in the top that I've worked with in those. But I mean, we had companies where we had an order for 20,000 of something, and they sent us like 10 prototypes. This is one of the reasons why I'm so paranoid about power, by the way, but they sent us 10 prototype power supplies. We beat the hell out of them and they were perfect. So then we ordered, all right, so let's order 5,000 more and then, ship them to us in bulk. And then we'll order more after that. The first bulk shipment, they swapped all the capacitors with cheap ass ones. And all the machines were shutting off after like 5 or 6 minutes. And that cost the company like probably $250,000. Had to go out in the field. We had to manually replace them. Lawsuits were threatened. It was a big deal. And that was for an order that would have just grown bigger and bigger and bigger. So, you know, to put that into perspective, the orders that we often place in retro, if there's no, you know, for simple boards, they're, you know, that's barely making them any money at all. So the fact that they pay attention to an order of five that I place just to do an ad, it's like, you know, that's important. Whereas, you know, seeing the failures, the massive intentional failures of some of these bigger companies, it's like, that was frustrating. There was a few of those too. There was a few major issues, but the power supply one was the one that was so blatantly like just a giant middle finger in the face to us.
Yeah, I've been pretty lucky with that, you know, the files I sent off to have manufactured. But yeah, I can easily see where some of these cheaper build houses would kind of cut corners and just use some really crappy build process and generate just junk.
Yeah. You know. There was a motherboard company out in Taiwan that was doing that with their boards too. They were sending out pre-production embedded board samples. This is 2006, by the way. So I'm not going to name the company because I don't even know if they're still around, and if they are, who knows, but they were sending out pre-production samples that were good. And then the manufacturing ones, some of the connectors weren't soldered on all the way, like the LVDS video connectors and stuff like that. And it's just like, how, like you look at it, it's like, how could this happen? Like is there zero QA? Cause that's the only way this could happen, is zero quality assurance and this stuff. So
yeah, it's kind of interesting because I've started seeing some of the guys in the retro scene now have their own SMD assembly line in house. Crix, like, he has his own in house where he can spin up the boards. All he has to do is have a batch of PCBs created. And as long as he has the components in line, he can just whip off as many megas, his mega everdrives, or, you know, or whatever he needs. He can just churn them out left and right. And then there's like Lotharic in Poland. Which you and I have talked about him. He has his own SMD assembly line as well. Pick and place machine along with the thing that has all the spools and materials and stuff. And he can do the same thing where once he gets the PCBs, the fiberless PCBs in, he can just start creating as many of whatever he needs. He's not reliant on a third party to do that. And I think as some of the prices come down on some of that stuff, you'll start seeing some more and more of these companies, the smaller outfits, tired of being constrained by the limitations of these big organizations that don't want to deal with them, or they give them just some really crappy deal. So now they can just start whipping off boards on their own.
Yeah. Matthias did that. The person who reverse engineered the Game Gear motherboard, he's got a pick and place machine. I think he was telling me that he was able to get it through his company used much cheaper. So while it is something that, you know, it's like 10, 20 grand for one of those, if you're in the right place at the right time, it's much cheaper. So that would make sense. I'd love one of those, but not only would I have no place to put it and can't afford it, like all I would be doing is making my friends designs for them. But just that's one of those things, like, you know, we need a couple RMC caves around the planet, and we need them to be like half production, half museum, interactive museum, like Neil's been doing it. Because I would love to fill up an entire basement there with, like, you know, a pick and place machine, a couple of 3D printers and stuff like that. So smaller creators could just sit there and say, you know, they could bring their designs. They could do their own QA there. So when it comes down, they could test them and be part of it and kind of help smaller creators get started. But hey, if you pick one up, you could be, you know, you could have that service where you start making things for people like that.
I don't foresee that happening anytime soon, but hey, yeah, you never know.
Come on, you wouldn't want a pick and place machine? You could fit it back there somewhere.
I could probably use one, but no, I don't think I want to invest that kind of money. You'd have to have those guys have a lot of different designs they build. You know, they make sense for them when they're, you know, especially Crix. I mean, I don't know how much of his stuff he sells, like what his quantities look like, but man, for him, that's definitely justified, you know?
Hmm. Yeah, and it's one of those things too where, you know, as much as I was joking about you getting a pick and place machine, if you're taking on that project, that means that you're doing the quality assurance, you're double checking the designs. There's a lot of responsibility that goes, whereas if you have a maker's day where, you know, you could rent out the shop for a day and set everything up and do it yourself, if anything goes wrong, it's your fault, so you can't blame the people running the shop. You just got to pay for your materials and everything else. It's not, you know, it's a good way to help you get started, but yeah, it's a lot of responsibility. We talked, I think, I can't remember if we did it on a podcast or just on the phone, but I talked to Steve from HD Retrovision about that. Like, a month after we met, like, hey, you know, we should start up a company where we get to make these products for people. And he was like, there is no fucking way I would ever do that. No, you give too much responsibility. You know, I'm not going to check every single part of every design. That's a hard no. And I'm like, all right, fine.
Well, I can tell you firsthand, some of these companies, especially in Europe, you know, if you send them a design that, you know, that, you know, work's been produced before, and they send up, you know, your finished boards back and they don't work, they're basically going to tell you to take a walk off a cliff.
Yeah.
And, yeah, and to be honest, unless you got the big, deep pockets to pursue them in court, you pretty much just had to eat it.
Yeah. So it's kind of funny. When I told you about the power supply and the capacitors, we went through a U.S. distribution shop. So because we went through that, we lost a lot of money with every sale because we had to pay this person out of Massachusetts and they paid the people in Taiwan. But because of that, we were able to legally say, we're not paying for anything and you're chipping in for some of the money that we had to spend to replace them. And if we had gone direct to China for that, they would have just laughed and just stopped responding to our calls. So it was one of those things where it was like, you know, you got to understand what's legal and what's right versus what actually happens are very often not the same thing at all.
Yeah, exactly. You gotta be careful who you trust to be your build partners on this stuff. Cause yeah, if they fuck it up, they're liable to just be like, sorry, that's that. You know, they might offer you a discount on the future, but that doesn't change the fact that you just had 1,000 PCBs created with parts on them and you can't get those parts back. So it's like, you just got to eat the whole process. They're like, oh, we'll give you a 10% discount next time around. Well, that doesn't help me now.
That stuff's frustrating, but you know, that's the lesson we learned, was that we needed a QA person in Asia all the time. And that was me. I was bouncing back and forth between Shenzhen, Taipei, Statesville, North Carolina, which was our final assembly plant, and then back to Connecticut where the main office was. And that was me for like basically 5 years, maybe four years were like a constant rotation. And I almost, before the second economic crash back then, they wanted to get me an apartment out there so that I could go 1 month there, 1 month here, so that we would not have those issues and bounce back and forth. But for a company who does this entire thing for a living, that makes sense. For, you know, for a small shop making things in runs of 500 or 1,000, like you'll spend more in travel or in hiring somebody than you will in any profit. So it's kind of the least evil, or the lesser of all the evils is what you have to choose in that scenario, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, we talked about RetroFrog. We talked about your origin channels. We bullshitted just like we would if we were hanging out in person. did I forget anything? Was there something we wanted to talk about? I just kind of like doing these as if we were at a coffee shop or a bar hanging out and inviting everybody else to come join in. So.
Yeah, we might have to do this again sometime.
Absolutely. This was fun. We're definitely going to catch up at some point. I'll continue to feature your designs because I think they're great and they're helpful. And I don't care if it's feet for an AES or if it's an elaborate 3D printed design. If I think it's cool, it's going up on the site. So a lot of people made fun of how excited I got about that. But when you put your AES down and it doesn't move, that's a big deal now. It's not sliding all around. So keep up. Keep up the good work, man.
I like I create solutions for problems you didn't know you had.
There you go. Well, thanks for your time. I'll leave links to absolutely everywhere people could find you, and we'll follow up again in a little bit and do another one.
All right. Appreciate it. Thanks.